Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update here at JM in the AM from a mysterious, undisclosed location. It's Mr. Malcolm Honlein. Good morning, sir.
Good morning to you, and good night, Yantif, and all the rest.
It's all undisclosed. The only hint I'll give everybody is that Malcolm had to wake up very early. Usually on Friday to join us, he wakes up early. Today he had to wake up very early to join us. That's quite a comprehensive hint, if I say so myself.
Actually, the time difference isn't as great as what it would be.
I think most people think now you're in Alaska, when in reality you're just off by about an hour or so. But anyway, so may I be philosophical on this Erev Pesach, Mr. Honlein? Can this be a little bit of a different segment today because the holiday, the big holiday, begins tonight?
Really?
Now you're just finding out? First of all, if this statistic is correct, and you could probably tell me a more accurate statistic than the one I found out about this morning, if this statistic is correct, I have that 80% of residents, Jewish residents in the state of Israel, will be sitting down for a Seder tonight. I have it at 80%. Malcolm, your latest statistics have it at what? About 80?
About 90%.
About 90%. If, in fact, that's accurate, and why would we believe that it's not, then tonight in Israel, it's a major important step in the culmination of Jewish history. In other words, and you know what I mean by this, and unfortunately doesn't get recognized by most, but we are in our own, not we, but you know what I mean, our people are in our own sovereign land, the one promised by God, the one that was on everyone's mind to the moment they left Egypt thousands of years ago. And in that land, the Jewish citizens are keeping a Pesach Seder of whatever type, but obviously, you know, eating matzah and fulfilling some of the commandments, if not all, for the Pesach Seder, at a rate of 80 to 90%. When you stop and think about it, that's astounding. Does it strike you as such on this Erev Pesach?
I mean, I think it's encouraging. And for those, you know, who talk about Israel as being a secular society, the fact is that for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, for the Chagim, although many of the resorts are full and some people leave the country and go away, the fact that percentage indicates that they are celebrating it here. I saw a statistic of a new study supposedly showing more than two-thirds of American Jews participate in the Seder. I would bet that the number is higher, even if it's just a festive family meal or something. The Seder certainly occupies, together with Hanukkah, and maybe Rosh Hashanah, the most important part of on the calendar.
Well, Yom Kippur, they fast at a rate of what in Israel? Also 80%?
It's very high, yeah, even more.
I mean, it's unbelievable.
80%, yeah.
So sometimes we have to
And about two-thirds, more than two-thirds of Israelis say that they light candles or make kiddush Friday night.
On a weekly basis.
Even if they don't necessarily keep Shabbos. But there is that connection still.
So sometimes, Mr. Honlein, especially when we are being levied with accusations about giving scary or negative news, sometimes we have to pause and say, look where the Jewish people are and look what's happening in 2012, much different than even recent Jewish history.
I was actually thinking about this yesterday, that when we say Dayenu, you could write a modern Dayenu. A Dayenu that says, you know, if God had only given us Israel, Dayenu, if God had only allowed the country to be safe and secure, Dayenu, that we would have Yerushalayim, that we would have Har HaBayit. I mean, there are so many things that we take for granted, and that maybe somebody ought to sit down and try to reconstruct Dayenu, just for the sense of putting things into perspective, that, you know, we talk about the bad, and there is much good. And over the past year, we've seen changes. There are still great dangers, and we have to be aware of it and keep focus on it. But I think you're right that we don't look at the other side of the ledger.
And the other iron,
for good reason, because we focus on what's most immediate and what demands our attention.
And the other irony, and again, I don't mean to get negative, but the other irony is that when those this afternoon try to go up to Har HaBayit, to the Temple Mount, and quote-unquote bring the Paschal Lamb, again, I'm not talking now halachically, I'm just saying there is a group of people that tries to do that every year, and when Jews do try to go into certain areas or occupy certain legal residences, etc., it is in fact our own people. How different is that in history, that it's our own people that are preventing those things from happening?
Well, it's complicated why it's prevented and why the conclusions are drawn by security forces, by others, as to what is best. I think sometimes the judgment is wrong. Sometimes there has to be more pressure, as we see this week on the Harazetim, the subject we've talked about for a long time, for years, as you know, the Mount of Olives, and where the desecrations of graves and the attacks on individuals has continued. Well, this week, finally, the police station was opened there, and we have for the first time a permanent presence, and that the graves of tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people will have some, will be much more secure. People going there recently, a chassan, on the day before his wedding, went to visit the grave of his motherhood to see it died just recently, and he was viciously attacked, and had him go down the aisle with all the bandages and scars. So the responsibility rests with us, and not to take for granted what we have, and certainly not to take Israel for granted.
By the way, I meant to ask you the following question. You're somewhat familiar with the procedure of selling chametz, right? You've been doing it your entire life. Did Warren Buffett make a good investment or a bad investment when he purchased that chametz this week?
Well, where it takes no investment on his part, he has the potential to make a profit. That's always a good deal.
So that's why Buffett ran for it. It was one of those win-wins, as he's used to participating in.
I think that's true.
I'll tell you, nothing like fun on an Erev Pesach, huh? By the way, before we get into some of the details regarding what's happening in this crazy world of ours, we should note, 10 years ago tonight, the Pesach Seder massacre in Israel, the Park Hotel in Netanya. And isn't it amazing, as you know, because the rally in Washington was just a few weeks later, right? Wasn't it just a couple of weeks after that?
A couple of weeks after Pesach.
So, as you know, it was that attack that really mobilized worldwide Jewry much differently than what we're used to, where, you know, most people really don't step up. And I guess that really, again, speaks to what this holiday is all about. The holiday meaning tradition, family, the importance of the Pesach Seder to the Jewish people around the world. And you saw it. You saw how the common person in the Jewish community around the world was affected by that attack.
Absolutely. Very much affected by it. And it galvanized Jewish public opinion and certainly had a tremendous impact in the world as a whole. But the rally would not have been possible. And that Chol HaMoed, as soon as it happened, we made the decision that we had to do something out of the ordinary. And the very fact that within 10 days of the decision, we could pull together what may have been one of the two or three biggest rallies ever held in Washington was a tremendous expression of the Achdus of Klal Yisrael, of the unity of the Jewish people and of many non-Jewish people. I think it's the message of Haggadah, which is about Jewish peoplehood and about the unity of the Jewish people, that happening over Pesach, I think, galvanized people in a way that many events did not. And the tendency is that as soon as something happens, like in Toulouse just recently,
yep,
you know, for 3-4 days people pay attention to it, and then it's history.
And that's the end of that. In the case of the Netanya attack, it lingered for a while.
Well, in France, actually, you know, they've been deporting now imams. They deported 5 or 6 this week. They have been acting against some of the cells. Now, the question is, why didn't they do this before?
Right.
Why, after the murder of 3 soldiers, did they not react and start looking for who was responsible with the same kind of aggressiveness? Is this tied to the political campaign France is right now in the middle of a very heated presidential race, and it adds a note of cynicism to what is being done. But all of a sudden now they're exposing this huge network of extremists, and just deporting a few imams is not the way to deal with it, as history teaches, because they get replaced with people who are getting more extreme.
Right. 2 minutes before 8 o'clock, it's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listeners-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Malcolm Holine is with us, weekly update pre-Pesach edition here at JM in the AM. By the way, if the episode of the Exodus and the way God dealt with Pharaoh and his people is any indication, it would seem that God does not really favor totalitarian dictatorships, certainly when they're targeted against his chosen people, right? That's one of the conclusions one can reach from the episode in our history. From a politically philosophical standpoint, why is it, excuse me, why is it that when we see this push for democracy, rallies and demonstrations to change things in these totalitarian governments, why is it that so often, just a few months later, and you can give a million examples, just a few months later, the government that arises is far more corrupt, and if there's such a thing, more totalitarian than the previous one?
Because for one thing, these were never about democracy. That was perhaps for a few people a motivation, but by and large was not what drove people into the streets. It was food, it was economics, it was desire for change, it's the Sunni-Shiite battle, the things that I discussed at the time, and all of a sudden now I see all these analyses where people are all of a sudden discovering what this was about and how the reaction to it misread the significance of the events that were taking place, and that, can't recreate a failed state and all of a sudden believe that it's going to be a massive change, as we're seeing in Egypt this week with the announcement of a candidate from the Muslim Brotherhood, even though they promised not to run for the presidency. And this guy who stepped down, al-Shadr, stepped down, a member, though he was a leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, right, as if that changes anything. And he's quite extreme in his views. It may have been driven by the fact that they were afraid that somebody from the Salafist, even more extreme group, would win, or that they wouldn't have complete control over the presidency.
But someone similar to him will win, correct?
Exactly. Yeah. There's no chance. He will win because they're the best organized and they have the best infrastructure to deliver a victory for him. But the fact that people now are expressing shock that the Muslim Brotherhood would violate their word, I mean, what do they think they are? What do they think that we're dealing with? That they went back on their word not to run for the presidency? There
we go. We've seen leadership in Egypt flip-flop a lot. We'll be talking about
it. By the way, none of the candidates is particularly good, and many of them have talked about reintroducing Sharia, breaking the relations with Israel, hitting the United States. I mean, all sorts of things that, and we're seeing articles how to destroy Israel appearing, the Muslim Brotherhood being much more open. And the fact is that I think, as always, this was not their original intent. Their intent is to win control, not responsibility. Now, this guy is a millionaire businessman, and we will see that they will be able to disassociate if they want to from him. But the fact is that they're going for broke now because they realize that the army, which controls 30% of the economy, is trying to protect its interests. You have other elements protecting their interests, and these guys want to take over and want to institute the Islamic law. We saw Turkey this week, the same thing. You know, here's the guy touted as the man the president speaks to most often in the Middle East and then maybe in the world. You know, meeting with Khamenei, going to standing with Ahmadinejad in Turkey and declaring that they're united against the Western arrogance, which is a code word for the United States and the interests of the West, telling Khamenei we can dismantle the NATO installations, radar installations in Turkey. And yet, no consequence, no price. We still continue to see Turkey touted. The Iranians then turn on him and say, we're not going to have negotiations, right, in Ankara. I mean, people look at this and think that there's some coherence to this. I mean, it's ridiculous. And we did see, though, finally, the beginnings of the coming together of the opposition in Syria, I've heard of incidents even inside the city of Damascus.
And the number of refugees and the number of those being assassinated continues to rise.
Yesterday, 2,800 people went to Turkey, sought refuge in Turkey just yesterday. The number of people being killed consistently rises, even though we're on the there's supposed to be a ceasefire talks on the April 10th, and there have been fresh violence is breaking out all the time. I mean, this is all going to be a sham. The question of whether Assad lasts, I think, has changed over the week because the opposition is being promised $100 million from Saudi Arabia and from the Gulf states for arms for to pay salaries, which could mean that you'd have many more defections of soldiers from the Syrian army if they knew that they will, in fact, be able to get their salaries and that they will be able
right.
to...
Even before this,
the people.
Even before this offer, was it clear that Saudi Arabia wants him out?
Oh yes, they had some sort of a love hate relationship for a long time, but mostly hate, and the hate is now no more love. The Saudis want him out completely. You also have a clash here between Saudi Arabia and Turkey over who is the hegemonic power for the Sunnis in the Middle East. And Turkey, having played this assertive role, now Saudi Arabia is playing a much more assertive role, but they definitely want Assad out.
Does Bibi know that, just going back to Egypt for a second, after all, there's such a big focus of ours tonight, that's the Egyptians. Does Bibi know that, that there's no hope for an Israeli-Egyptian relationship, any type of cordial arrangement, and that things are going to be a lot different than they've been for the last three decades?
That's actually a good point, and that Israel has to look at this with grave concern because Egypt is the biggest neighbor, and for many years, despite the fact that you had a cold relationship, the fact is you've had a quiet border with virtually no instances along that border. Egypt accounts for 50% of Israel's security planning because it's a border there, and because the situation at Sinai continues to deteriorate. You had a rocket fired at Eilat this week by groups inside Sinai, and Israel is restrained in its response because they don't want to exacerbate the situation with Egypt. But there's going to come a point where they're no longer going to be able to do that. So for Israel, Egypt, the changes in Egypt are of dramatic significance.
Why? I mean, I hate to even ask this because you don't want to suggest anything, but why is it that it seems that the other cities along the Gaza border, for instance, are always getting bombarded by these barrages of rockets, and in Eilat we always see these isolated incidents?
Well, first of all, because it's further, and it's you really have to fire from the Sinai, and the chances that it just lands in open desert is much greater. You do have every once in a while some sort of penetration from Gaza, from the Egyptian border. It can be by sea, it can be by land, and Israel takes tremendous precautions there. The Israeli Navy and others, they've installed sensors and detection equipment, etc. But we saw some pretty devastating attacks over the years against Eilat when rockets are fired directly at the city, or terrorist attacks that were targeted the civilians there. So that the only reason is there are more attempts that have been caught, and there are the distances that make it easier to fire into Sderot or to
right.
Ashkelon.
Right. In Hebron, the Machpelah house, Beit HaMachpelah, was evacuated. It seemed like the prime minister was trying to stall for time on this issue and act as if he was trying to placate those who were in the house, differently than episodes that have happened in the past. Was I imagining that, or was he trying to come to a more peaceful resolution than other incidents we've seen?
More peaceful resolution of what?
Compared to other incidents that we've seen where the Israeli government has taken very aggressive steps right away, here it looked like, in terms of the dialogue that Netanyahu was involved with, that he was trying to to see if he could calm things down and do things a little different.
I'm sorry, it just broke for a minute. Look, nobody wants an explosion now inside Israel. And because there are, I think, legitimate legal grounds that can be asserted about why they have a right to be there. And I think Netanyahu has tried in this regard, in regard to Migron and other things, to work out resolutions to problems rather than to have a repetition of some of the bloody scenes that we've seen in the past. So I think for political reasons, maybe ideological reasons, but for practical reasons, that approach is wise, that you want to try and work things out. And if they legitimately bought the building and if they have a right to be there, then they can assert that, and they're going to have to deal with it.
Any additional fallout in the big change in Kadima after the primary last week? And if we had Bibi here and he was giving us an honest assessment of his own political position, is he in a better situation now because of the leadership of Mofaz in the Kadima party?
I don't think it dramatically changes things. You know, in Israel, we have a syndrome sort of like the primaries in the Republican Party, where every month somebody else emerges and everybody touts them, and then they fade back like Yair Lapid or Shelly Yachimovich, and you know, the numbers go up and down, and every time you propose a change, you see Labor gets up 5, and this one goes down 10. I think that the opposition is not united, and that the that Mofaz may be more credible to some people over the long term, and provide, given his background as a minister of defense and chief of staff, and more than Tzipi Livni, I meant. But it could also be that he will more likely lead Kadima into the government, which could further split it. And there's talk now of a split in Kadima. I think that will not happen. I think you may have some defections. But I don't think Bibi right now is concerned that there's anybody who can challenge him politically. What he doesn't want is a collapse of the coalition, except at the time of his choosing, so that he sets the stage for the election about when it takes place and what takes place.
Mm. And we've seen him try to manipulate the dates of certain elections to his benefit, so that'll be a very important piece that he will control. When a German Nobel laureate says that Israel is a threat to world peace, is the Israeli government leadership responsible to get up and make a statement?
No, and I would not do it because I wouldn't elevate it. There are a lot of editorials and things in Europe against what Günter Grass wrote, and the fact that Prime Minister or others respond to it, I think, elevates it too much. He's a credible person. He was a poet who was considered pro-Israel at times. But this piece was over the top, and I don't think it influences many people in the long run.
According to the Jerusalem Post, Israel made known yesterday its agenda for renewed negotiations with Iran over its nuclear program, calling, among other things, for a surrender of its enriched uranium stockpile. Is that, in fact, a deal maker or deal breaker if the uranium stockpile is not handed over or abandoned?
It is a critical issue, and it's part of the subterfuge that Iran engages in all the time. I mean, these talks are meant just to delay and obfuscate. There's no indication that they have any serious intent to cooperate or to be party to a serious agreement. They are hurting economically. The sanctions are having a tremendous impact. They admit now to unemployment at about 34-35%, when a couple of weeks ago they said it was 11%, which means it's much higher than that. And half of the people who are remaining at work getting half the salary of what they got before. I met with people from Iran, key dissidents, just yesterday. And when you hear their description of what's really taking place in the country, it's really quite remarkable on how little we really know of the corruption, of the reasons why certain things take place, including involvement in Syria, because IRGC officials and officers for many years, you know, used Syria as their playground. They would live the religious life in Iran and then go across the border to Syria, and many of them had second families there.
Huh.
You know, I'm serious. When you hear that Ahmadinejad stole 130,000 documents which is why they're accusing him now, and why many people are being silenced, because he has the Secret Service records on a lot of the key leadership, and he's threatening to reveal it, in addition to the billions that he allegedly stole, or that they, and there was a hearing in the Majlis in the Parliament, if you remember, 10 days ago, and he mocked them. It was shocking, you know, that he would go before them. It's because he knew he had a Trump card against them all. So the what you hear from people, including one who was a founder of the Iran Revolutionary Guard, about the true situation in Iran, you know that in fact, if the West is tough with them and stops the game of always thinking that if somehow you can cajole them, you can co-opt them, that the only thing that works is a tough message that is really credible. And it's why, you know, the recent leaks and things about Azerbaijan, whether true or not, but everything that says, you know, Israel doesn't have the capability, or the United States doesn't have the capability, or trying to diminish Israel's ability to take that option if it proves necessary, only sends a message to the Iranians that they have nothing to worry about.
Yeah.
So we see the sanctions are working. We know that we could do much more if we would support the forces inside Iran that want change. But the West ignores them. The West does not help them.
Yeah.
And the same thing with the Syrian opposition. Now we're beginning to see some changes, but the performance of the West at these meetings is ridiculous. We're not showing them a cohesive force and really getting behind it.
It is unbelievable to me, and I'm sure to you as well, especially as we speak on this Erev Pesach, that a Jewish leader like yourself publicly says, can you imagine that a Jewish leader like yourself says that Israel has the capability that if need be to eliminate the enemy, or to even discuss the possibility that Israel might have to go ahead and do it? Tell a Jew living 70, 80, 700, 800 years ago, and they would never believe that such a statement could ever be uttered. It's just unbelievable. Sorry to get philosophical, but...
No, but that's the dynamic that we talked about before. That it would be enough if we had a state of Israel, but it would be enough that you have a state of Israel that has an army and air force that has the ability to protect Jews.
Unbelievable.
We take it for granted. We don't really think about it.
Maybe tonight that could be part of the message to our kids, everybody. Maybe tonight that could be part of the message of the Pesach.
That's the whole message of tonight, is V'Hegadta L'Levincha, is that this is not just an exercise in, you know, they wanted to kill us, we won, let's eat. That to teach the children, to get them to understand what is the significance. There's so many messages in the Haggadah that are relevant for today. If people don't use it as an opportunity to educate, to talk, to tell the relevance of everything in the Haggadah to today, and to teach them the good things too, to tell them, look at the wonderful things that we have had. We could say, you know, if one of them, if two of them, if five of them, if ten of them, we should be dancing in the streets and rejoicing.
So true. Unbelievable. Malcolm, we wish you a Chag Kosher v'Sameach. If I'm not mistaken, there's a good chance, obviously next week is Shvi Shal Pesach, but there's a good chance that 2 weeks from now, when you're in Eastern Europe, we will connect and hopefully update people on what's happening.
God willing, we're working on it, and we're trying to pull it all together. But people should watch in the next days some of the, you know, this important decision that came down in the Supreme Court, and what the administration will do and others to challenge it. We know that it's far from over. That that people be very careful. That shuls and others take extra precautions. You know, the police are doing their part, but we have to do our part. Just see how the Palestinian Authority this week, a leading guy said Moses, in fact, was a Palestinian, and Yitzias Mitzrayim was the first war of liberation of the Palestinians. If they can want to usurp it, it's something of value. Show the kids the value of it.
100%. Thank you so much. Enjoy your Yontif.
My pleasure. Be well.
Malcolm Hohnlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.